After taking a shower, he got out his laptop to research crop circles in more depth. He clicked on one of the most popular crop circle databases in England, which had a huge library of aerial photography. The site had cataloged photos for the past 25 years and gave an overview of the phenomenon. The average circle was 200 feet across, though some spanned up to 1,000 feet. Many of the circles showed up on farms with gently sloping hills. As Rowan clicked through the pictures, he became more and more spellbound. He'd never looked at crop circles up close before. The geometrical designs were stunning in their intricacy and held a timeless, poetic grace. He read that the circles usually formed overnight, without fanfare, during the summer months before harvest. The full grandeur of the designs could only be viewed from the sky. Most circles were created during the shroud of night, sometime within a span of 6 to 7 hours, though a few had miraculously appeared during the day in minutes. One notorious circle in 1996, nicknamed the Julia Set, appeared near Stonehenge during the day, according to eyewitnesses and Stonehenge security guards. The field next to the busy highway and ancient monument had been clear all day, and then suddenly, within minutes, everyone noticed an exquisite design had miraculously materialized. Even more incredible, the design was an arrangement of 149 circles in an intricate fractal pattern representing the Julia Set, a complex mathematical formula. Rowan made a note of the other crop circles researchers had flagged. They were significant because they showed the circles could not have been made by any known conventional methods. The Milk Hill crop circle in 2001 appeared in full glory one night over the hills of Pusey Vale. The enormous design was approximately 900 feet wide, the length of 2.5 football fields, and curved in an intricate spiral that divided into 6 sections that contained 409 circles inside of them. The Milk Hill Circle was the Empire State Building of crop circles. No one could fathom how any person or group could create such a masterpiece within hours, in the dead of night, and under wet and windy weather conditions, and yet the circle was fully formed by dawn. A brilliant work of art lit by the morning sun for all the world to see. In 2000, the Pickett Hill Circle, a fractal sunflower pattern, was also flagged. The design contained 44 spirals and 14 concentric rings. 44 divided by 14 equaled 3.142, better known as pi. The design was near impossible to draw on paper, much less in a field at night. Were the circles messages, written in a language based on math? One circle was a replica of a DNA strand, and another appeared in the fields next to the Chilbolton Observatory, with pixelated squares that were almost identical to the pattern of a binary code sent up into space in 1974 with the purpose of contacting other life forms. To anyone analyzing the pixels on the field, the design read like a reply. The database showed the marked differences between fabricated circles, which were crudely created by someone with tape measures and stomp boards that crushed the plants, and the geometry was far from accurate. The other circles, the unexplainable ones, were geometric masterpieces. Their creations left plants unharmed, lying on their side. Those circles remained just that, unexplainable. One crop circle researcher, a pilot who had devoted his career to documenting the circles from the air and on the ground, believed that the way the world was turning its eyes from these unexplainable masterpieces was a phenomenon in itself. Like clockwork, dozens of new circles appeared around Great Britain each summer from April to August. No two circles were ever alike. Some circles' geometric designs were so confounding and impossible to create that they would spark renewed widespread public interest. Then the science hoax argument would start and quickly stalemate all over again. Rowan clicked on the links to all the aerial photos of crop circles from the present year. The designs were stunning, geometric like mandalas. The more he read, the more Rowan found himself sliding down the rabbit hole of something he didn't understand. Now it was almost 3 in the morning and he couldn't sleep. Why did Miguel and Stuart think the Uparts were connected? Crop circles were fantastical enough. How did the two tie together? When his cell phone rang, disrupting his thoughts, at first Rowan thought it was Stuart. Only a few people knew his private number. Hello?
Rowan? It's Mellicent Tilpin.
Rowan sat up, suddenly alert. She sounded strange, and he could hear the quake in her voice. Something had happened. He launched out of bed. Are you all right?
Someone set my house on fire. My mother's house.
Her voice broke, her words spilling out in a tangled rush.
A stranger came to my house. I felt the doorknob. I saw him. I think he may come back. I need your help. I need to protect my brother.
Rowan was already getting dressed and throwing his things into his bag. Are you safe? Where are you?
Our neighbor's right across the street. I'm sorry to call so late. I don't know what to do.
I'll be right there. I'm nearby. Rowan's mind was already in the zone, looking ahead to carve out a plan. The fire had to be connected to the group and the Uparts. There was no question in his mind. Once whoever did this discovered that Mellicent had survived, would they come back again? You need to be out of Los Angeles before the 6 a.m. news reports on the fire. I can make that happen.
Leave town? With you?
She tripped on the words. We'll talk about the plan when I get there. Come out when you see me. Bring your brother.
Wait, you don't know my address.
I know your address, Mellicent. He couldn't help the soft edge that found its way into his voice. She'd been easy to find. Anyone else who was looking could find her too.
17. The wristband. After Mellicent hung up, she tried to calm the adrenaline still coursing through her. She was sequestered in the Mercer's guest bathroom. She splashed water on her face and took several deep breaths, her body still shaking from the shock of the night. The Mercers had finally gone back to sleep after Mellicent encouraged them. The elderly couple was distraught, too, but needed to rest. They gave her and Parker a change of clothes, fresh towels to shower with, and an invitation to help themselves to anything in the kitchen. Parker had showered first, and then Mellicent. She brought her cell phone into the bathroom so she could talk in private. She thought Parker would be asleep from exhaustion, but he was sitting on the guest bed and waiting for her with his arms crossed.
Who was that you were talking to?
A friend. Mellicent hesitated, not sure how else to explain Rowan West. She sat down next to him and hoped her brother wouldn't be freaked out by what she was about to say. Park, I need you to trust me.
Of course I trust you.
He sounded offended. The fire tonight was meant for me. That statement lingered in the air. He frowned at her.
Because you found the watch?
No, because of how I found it. She put her hands on her legs in front of her. My friend thinks whoever did this may come after me again. He wants to help us.
How do you know he didn't start the fire?
Because I saw the face of the man who did.
When?
Parker gaped at her in disbelief.
You saw him at the house?
No. In my mind, when I touched the doorknob to the garage. Parker covered his face with his hands, looking like he might break down and cry.
I don't believe this, Mel.
I know, I'm sorry. I can't control what I see or when I see it. But I also can't ignore it anymore. She reached out and touched his knee. We need to go. My friend's coming to pick us up right now.
The psycho?
He looked at her, appalled. Would you quit calling him that? She said, trying to keep her voice down. Parker glared and lowered his voice, too.
Fine, then you're the psycho. What about the Mercers? We're just gonna run off in the middle of the night?
We'll leave them a note.
And go where?
I don't know, anywhere but here. We need to leave town. She nodded to the accordion file where their passports were. I was already planning on it.
I was going to tell you.
Parker stared at the accordion file in shock. He was about to say something, but then changed his mind.
What about the investigation? The house. Won't it look suspicious that we're skipping town?
I'll call and tell them we didn't feel safe in L.A. because of the arson and are staying with a friend out of town.
A friend you don't even know?
Parker was practically choking on the words.
He could be a serial killer, a complete wacko, and we're getting into his car like a bad 80s movie.
Parker, Rowan is like me. He's here to help us.
What do you mean, like you? He air-quoted her.
Would you stop doing that? She swatted his hand. He can sense things with his hands. Even more than I can.
How do you know?
Because he proved it. Everything Rowan had said about her and her mother from touching the snow globe was not only true, but true with a specificity that still astounded her. And what he'd done with the lanterns was on a whole other level.
Well, he's got to prove it to me. Parker crossed his arms. Or I'm not going anywhere.
Fine, ask him when you see him. She threw up her arms in exasperation.
But we're leaving. Now.
Parker looked ready to challenge her. But when she opened the guest room door and motioned for him to go, he did. As he walked past her, he whispered,
I hope you know what you're doing.
She turned off the guest room light and quietly shut the door. She hoped so, too. Across the street, the violent remnants of the fire stood etched against the night shadows. What was left of the house had been cordoned off. The doors and windows were gone, leaving only a blackened, half-standing frame. It was 3:30 in the morning, still the dim hours before dawn. But Mellicent knew the person who had done this would return to assess the aftermath. She didn't want to be anywhere on this street when he came back. The Mercers, when they woke, would see her note on the entry hall table. She had written, Thank you for the clothes. A friend came to pick us up and we'll be staying with him. Talk soon. When Roan drove up in front of the house, relief rippled through her. He'd come. She turned the bottom lock of the Mercer's front door and pulled it shut. Parker stood stiff beside her, an unwilling participant, and gave her a disapproving look she ignored. She hurried down the walkway to the car with her brother one step behind. Rowan motioned for her to get in, but Parker stepped in front of her.
No, you get in the back, Parker said protectively,
and he opened up the front passenger door. Mellicent muttered under her breath and hurried into the back seat to hear whatever her brother was about to say. When Parker got in, the two men assessed each other. Rowan finally offered,
You must be Parker.
I am.
Parker was eyeing him like this was all Rowan's fault. Thanks for getting us. Mellicent spoke up, meeting Rowan's gaze in the rearview mirror.
You're not hurt?
He searched her eyes and she shook her head, the trauma of the night still a cloud around her. Parker announced,
Before we go anywhere, I want proof.
Proof of what?
Rowan turned to him.
Of everything!
Parker raised his voice, becoming emotional.
My sister says you can do what she can do, only better. It's why you're here, to help her, so prove it.
Rowan met Millicent's gaze again in the mirror. Parker crossed his arms.
We're not going anywhere until you prove it.
Fine.
Rowan pulled off his right glove.
Give me a wristband.
Parker's hand went to his left wrist on reflex. Mellicent knew her brother never took the leather cuff off. She doubted he'd hand it over. Parker stalled by asking,
Why? You want proof? I need to borrow it. I'll give it back.
Rowan put the car in drive and started driving. Parker gripped the dash.
Wait, I said?
I know. But I suggest we do this on another street and not in front of your house.
Rowan turned the corner and found a spot several blocks down on a side street. He shut off the car's ignition and gave Parker his full attention.
Now, he said,
holding out his right hand like a magician about to perform a trick.
The wristband.
Melisent almost spoke up to warn her brother that he may not want to hand it over. After what Roan had discovered from touching her art at the store, no amount of money would make her give him her jewelry. But Parker surprised her by slipping it off.
Thank you.
Roan held the wristband with surprising gentleness and closed his eyes. After a moment, he opened them again and looked at Parker closely, a hint of surprise on his face. Then he said,
You got this in Hawaii. Your mother gave it to you. A woman was selling these at a gift stand where you had lunch. Your sister was there.
Roan's eyes glanced to Melisent in the back. She met his eyes in the mirror, holding her breath. He was looking at her like he was comparing her to how she'd been all those years ago. He dropped his gaze and focused on the wristband again.
The trip was a splurge, a surprise present from Sadie for the three of you. The owl carved into the leather is an aumakua, a family guardian in Hawaii. The woman selling it said it would bring you luck, and you never take it off.
The car was quiet. Parker was listening with bated breath. That trip was one of Parker's happiest memories. Roan jumped forward in time and announced,
You've been skipping school.
Parker snapped out of his daze and crossed his arms, defensive again.
Did my sister tell you that? To go to the cemetery.
Roan finished his sentence. Both Parker and Melisent were stunned into silence.
You bring your mother flowers. Carnations, because you can't afford anything else. You talk to her, clean the headstone, some days you cry. Some days you lie on the grass and read books. Some days you just sit, wondering if death would be easier.
He fingered the wristband.
You thought about digging a hole beside her grave and burying this with her because you don't feel lucky anymore at all.
Tears pooled in Parker's eyes as he listened to Roan go on. The intimacy within the car became stifling.
You don't want to burden your sister. You think her life will be better without you, and you've been planning to run away. That's why you were at BJ's that day to finalize your plan. He has a cousin up in Michigan you were going to stay with until you found work. Once you had the car...
Enough!
Parker yelled.
Enough!
He grabbed the wristband back and held it in both hands with a sob, bowing his head.
I'm sorry,
Roan began, but then stopped. Melisent was too stunned to say anything. The bottom of her world had given way. Parker had been spending all that time at the cemetery, and she'd assumed the worst. He was going to run away. From her.
Just drive.
Parker said, his voice sounding small. With those two words, he was giving Roan permission to help them. Roan put his glove back on and started the car. They drove in silence. Melisent was too dumbstruck by Parker's confession to make sense of what was happening, until Roan asked,
Do you have ID?
Sorry? She asked, her mind blank.
Do you have identification? Can you fly?
She nodded, and then realized he couldn't see her in the dark.
Yes. To where?
New Orleans.
Parker was staring straight ahead, vacant. What had happened tonight was too much. He'd passed the brink. Melisent was barely functioning herself. In one night, her entire life had been stripped away. She looked out the front window. There were few cars on Lincoln as they drove to LAX. She watched the road stretch out like a black band between the headlights, unspooling infinitely in the dark.
18. The window. Is it magic? Rowan looked up from his coffee to find Parker studying him. They were at the Atlantic Aviation Terminal at LAX, reserved for private planes, and sequestered in the corner of the lobby with coffee, waiting for their plane to fuel. Mellicent had stepped away to the ladies' room, leaving Parker and Rowan alone. "No," Rowan said with a faint smile. His proof in the car had fired up the 16-year-old's imagination. "I don't control anything. I only see it." Parker glanced down to his coffee cup as if it held better answers. Rowan could tell Parker wanted to talk, but didn't know how. What an earnest kid, Rowan couldn't help but think now that he'd read him. Rowan hadn't expected to feel so overwhelmed holding his wristband. Without warning, he'd gotten tangled up in all the joy, sadness, and pain inside it. Parker had worn that leather band every day for 6 years, and it held a trove of memories. Jewelry always did. The more worn, the denser. That wristband had been a time machine, showing Rowan the last years of Parker's childhood, before his voice had deepened and become a man's. Parker was still a boy, stretched inside a tall frame, a little boy afraid of heights, afraid of the dark, a boy who loved his mother and missed her very much. "I'm sorry about your house," Rowan offered in a quiet voice. He understood the power of home, and through the imprints had witnessed Mellicent's desperate attempt to save theirs. Helpless anger filled Rowan at whoever had done this to them. Parker nodded, trying to appear strong. In that moment, he looked so much like Mellicent, it was uncanny. The two siblings shared Sadie's fair coloring and same delicate features. Rowan would have loved to touch something of Sadie's to learn what had happened to Parker and Mellicent's father. Who was he? Why wasn't he in the picture? Then Rowan shook his head at himself. He had no right to be sifting through their past. Mellicent and Parker's family dynamics were none of his business. His eyes strayed across the lobby, watching Mellicent return to their seats. He felt a tightening in his gut, unable to ignore his growing attraction to her. His eyes swept her body, for the first time getting a good look at the bizarre floral sweatpants and jacket set she was wearing, no doubt borrowed from her elderly neighbor. It looked like sportswear a senior citizen would wear, a tiny one. The pants were too short, and the faux velvet jacket hugged her ribcage. When she walked, he caught a glimpse of skin at her waist. He met her eyes. She was watching him watch her. They stared at each other for a lingering moment. Rowan wondered what it'd be like to kiss her. She slid into the leather seat next to her brother. Rowan could see Parker picking up on the tension between them. Rowan's mouth twisted in consternation at the whole situation. Suddenly, his life had become incredibly complicated. They sat quietly until Mellicent said,
"I'd like to pay for our airfare."
"Please don't worry about it," Rowan tried to brush aside her offer.
"But it's too expensive."
"Really, it's not a problem. I've been finding and selling watches my whole life." It was why they were waiting in a terminal that looked like a hotel lobby instead of standing in line with the rest of LAX. Her lips pursed in a frown. He hadn't meant to sound cavalier, but it was true. He shook his head at himself for coming across wrong, something he seemed to do with her too easily, and he pulled out his cell phone to check email. Holly should have finished up her meeting with Fay Young and delivered the heirloom for the foundation. As he scrolled through his inbox, he could feel Parker scrutinizing him. The boy asked,
"Why are you really helping us like this? Flying us in a private plane? Who does that?"
Rowan could have told him helping people was what he did, although usually they were dead. He exercised his ability by returning lost heirlooms to their original owner's descendants. But the truth was, ever since he'd seen that YouTube video, Mellicent Tilpin was a comet that had come streaking across his world. Was he rescuing her or chasing her? Maybe both. And now he had her inquisitive 16-year-old brother to handle. An intent light shone in the boy's eyes, and Rowan could tell that nothing but the absolute truth would fly. He tried to explain. "My good friend in England is a psychometrist. He's part of a group of psychometrists who are researching out-of-place artifacts. Out of what? Out of place. They're called Uparts. Rowan reached into his bag and took out Hanush's key. He dropped it into Parker's hand. Like this one. Parker held up the key with a frown. Looks like an old key to me. Because it is. Rowan's eyes slid to Mellicent's. Then he took the key back and returned it to his bag. But to a psychometrist, we can sense the dual timelines running through it. These artifacts shouldn't be in the time and place they've been found, and there's no explanation as to why. So these psychometrists are trying to find the explanation? Mellicent asked. Rowan didn't offer the key to Mellicent, knowing the last thing she needed was to sense Hanush's lifetime. My friend Stuart's trying to tie the Uparts together and find a unifying factor. Parker frowned. So how many people are in this group? There were six, but now two of them are missing and one is dead, Rowan said bluntly. After the fire, Mellicent and Parker needed to know what had happened to the others. Parker was speechless. Mellicent's hand covered her mouth in a quiet gasp. Rowan looked at them gravely, his eyes settling on Parker. That's why we're taking the plane. After they boarded and took off, Rowan checked his watch. 6 a.m. Right on schedule. They were in the air as the morning news began. Whoever set the fire was probably still in L.A., but the arson had done its job, hiding the identity of whoever was behind it. Before Rowan had picked Mellicent and Parker up, he'd parked two blocks away and walked to the house and circled the perimeter. There had been no door left to touch and find the imprint Mellicent had mentioned. Rowan would have given anything to hold it. But he'd placed his hands on the trees and replayed the scene of the fire. A man had stood, hidden in the shadows, watching the house catch ablaze. He wore a hoodie up over his face, looking like a jogger in the cold. As the fire spread, the man hesitated and began to throw rocks at the bedroom window. When one shattered it, he ran off. Through the window, Rowan saw Mellicent get up and run out of the room and across the hall. He saw her through another window on the other side of the house. It was Parker's room. She threw her things into the yard and rushed to get her brother out. Parker didn't want to go. He was too afraid. Somehow Mellicent forced him. They made their way down and collapsed on the grass, heaving in air and hugging each other. Rowan stayed with the imprint. His mind was so honed, he was standing in the moment. The firefighters came and then the police. Rowan stood in the center of the memory as they tried to save the house and rush Mellicent and Parker to safety. He watched Mellicent get oxygen and a blanket. Then he followed her as she walked to her car. She opened the door and got in, crying alone in the dark. She found his card and clutched it in her hands. Rowan sat beside her in the shadow of the past, wanting so much to comfort her. But these moments had already happened. There were no imprints left for Rowan to investigate. The man in the hoodie had not been a jogger. Rowan desperately wanted to know who he was and how he was connected to them. Too many questions were flooding his mind. He folded his fingers into Vianna Madra to help his tension release. At least Mellicent and her brother were safe with him 35,000 feet up in the air. They were sitting on the other side of the aisle, staring out their windows as the clouds moved past, no doubt thinking about their circumstances and the bombshell he dropped on them at the airport by telling them what he did. Parker was the one who broke the silence. So what now? We just hide out in New Orleans? His eyes went to Mellicent. Skip school the rest of the year? I'll call the school. We need some time to figure this out. Mellicent was trying to stay strong for both of them. She looked over to Rowan. He asked her, You said you felt the doorknob and saw him. What did you see? She had touched her door and gotten an imprint. Right now, this arsonist was the only lead he had to finding Stuart. This person had to be connected to Stuart's disappearance. She hesitated, glancing at her brother. He wasn't from here. He came to L.A. to find me. She glanced at her brother again. What did he look like? How old? Rowan asked, trying to get her to dig deeper into the memory. Close your eyes and try and reimagine it. She did as he asked, and soon let out a shuddering breath.
Brown hair. 40s? Tall. He had a baseball cap on and sweats and a canvas bag across his shoulders, like an army duffel. He came to burn down the house.
Her voice caught. She looked at him. Her devastation grabbed at his heart, and Rowan immediately felt guilty for asking her to see a painful moment again. Rowan unbuckled his seatbelt and moved over to join them on their side of the aisle. He sat across from her. Hey, listen to me, he said gently, putting his hands on her knees. She looked at him in surprise. The connection between them was like a running current, growing stronger every minute. You two are going to stay in New Orleans where you'll be safe. I'm going to find out who's behind this. Think of your time there as a short trip. He would deposit them at a hotel downtown near the warehouse. Holly could watch over them while he went to London. Millicent nodded, defeat and despair on her face. In that moment, Rowan wanted nothing more than to hold her hand. For the first time, the barrier of his gloves frustrated him. He wanted to take them off. 19. The gift bags. After the plane landed in New Orleans, Rowan drove Millicent and Parker straight to their hotel, the Westin on Canal Place. He chose it because it was near the warehouse, and also the hotel had a mall next door. Parker and Millicent had no clothes, and would need to buy the bare necessities while they were there. Millicent was adamant on paying for the hotel room, and got Parker and herself two rooms that connected. Rowan made note of their room numbers so he could order flowers to be delivered to them as a precaution. I'm going up, Parker said, subdued, and took his room key from his sister. Thanks for helping us, he added to Rowan, and then turned to Millicent without meeting her eyes. See you later. I'm going to sleep. With a troubled look, Millicent watched her brother leave, and then she turned to Rowan with a sigh. He'll come around. Rowan had felt firsthand how much Parker loved his sister. Whatever misunderstanding stood between them wouldn't last long.
I still can't believe he was going to run away.
He's a complicated kid, was all he could say. Give him time. You've both been through a lot. Why don't you go get some rest, he suggested. I'll come back late this afternoon.
You're coming back? She asked in surprise.
He searched her eyes. You didn't expect me to just drop you off at a hotel and not come back. Her cheeks became flushed, and he added, I want you to meet Holly, my business partner. She's going to look after you while I'm gone. He watched her face fall in disappointment. She had no idea how expressive she was.
Where are you going?
London, tomorrow, only for a few days.
To look for your friend?
She crossed her arms with a thoughtful frown. The sooner I find out what happened to him, the sooner you two are safe. He took a step back to leave.
Wait! She grabbed his hand. Thank you for bringing us here. For everything.
He could feel the warmth of her hand through his gloves. He raised her hand and kissed it, something he'd never done to anyone before, and walked away. When Rowan got home, he took a long, steaming shower. He should have gone straight to bed to catch a few more hours of sleep. Instead, he came back downstairs and sat on the sofa, staring at the trove gift bags. He needed to return them to Millicent. The sooner the temptation to touch her artwork was gone, the better, because now he wanted to read the imprints more than ever. She was becoming an obsession. He wanted to know her. Maybe he would ask if he could keep one globe, the one he'd already handled. The others he would give back, upholding his promise not to touch them. But the snow globe with the rock garden he'd already held. So if he touched it again now, he wouldn't be breaking his word. There was nothing else to see. He'd already read all the imprints. Before he could second guess what he was doing, he reached in, took the snow globe out of the box, and leaned back on the couch. He rested the globe on his chest and closed his eyes. The weight of the rock rose and fell with each breath as he held it in his hands. His breathing calmed as his mind sifted through all the memories he knew were there, like a movie he wanted to watch again. Two people besides him and Mellicent had touched this globe before. One person was a customer from the Trove, a woman preoccupied by her twins fussing in their stroller. She had considered buying it as a birthday present for her mother, but put it back down when one of the babies started screaming. The mother left the store with a harassed look and an apologetic smile to Mellicent.
"Thanks, I'll come another time."
Mellicent was behind the register, her hair knotted into a twist with wooden chopsticks, just like in the YouTube video. She was bent over the counter, working intently on another snow globe. She looked up with a smile and waved. Sunlight streamed through the window, framing her in a luminous light. Rowan was captivated. He could watch that moment 100 times. He finally left the imprint and moved on to the next. The other person who'd handled it was the woman Mellicent worked for, Tish. Tish had held the globe for several minutes, gazing at it with a critical eye, thinking it wasn't that good. Tish's imprint was a long, raveling thread holding a lot of history and baggage between the two women. Tish was the one who had offered to let Mellicent sell her artwork at the store, and she gave Mellicent one small shelf in the back corner. The arrangement was that Mellicent could keep all the profits from anything that sold. But Tish regretted making the offer. In her mind, the crystal globes mounted on chunks of granite took up valuable space. "Who would want to buy this?" was all Tish could think. She'd picked up the rock garden snow globe, all the while wondering how she could steal the shelf back. Rowan grimaced at the bitter taste in his mouth and moved past Tish's negative imprint, impatient to get to Mellicent again. He adjusted his fingertips on the glass sphere as if fine-tuning an instrument until he was able to capture her. Mellicent sat at her desk in her bedroom, creating the sculpture. She liked to do a little bit at a time, late at night. Her eyes were focused on the task, but her mind was far away as she constructed the miniature rock garden. She was in her pajamas, boxer shorts, and a wispy camisole, her hair splayed over her shoulders with tendrils falling forward as she leaned closer to the desk. Rowan felt like a voyeur watching her, his mind's eye so focused on the moment he could have reached out to touch her. It was the first time an imprint had ever frustrated him, because he wanted it to be real. He'd learned early on as a child, imprints could never replace the present. The singularity of the present was what gave the now its power, but he'd also never wanted to choose an imprint over reality before. He watched her work until he drifted off to sleep, and his hands stayed wrapped around the crystal globe, cradling it, like it was the most priceless possession in the world.
20. The Peace Pipe. The key to getting Rowan West to talk, Mellicent noticed, was to ask him about history. In the 15 minutes they'd been in the car together, Rowan had regaled her and Parker with all kinds of historical trivia, painting a vivid picture of New Orleans as a city steeped in time, a grand melding of cultures, and a living doorway to the past. The biggest small town in the world had the country's oldest public market and the first cathedral in North America. Tennessee Williams had lived next to Gumbo Shop, and Mark Twain had had his fortune read just down the street when he was a Mississippi steamboat pilot before the Civil War. The other thing she noticed about Roan was that he sometimes talked about the past in the present tense, describing events as if they were still happening. It was disconcerting. She'd never heard another person do this.
"Thomas Jefferson tries to buy New Orleans and Florida from Napoleon in 1803 for $2 million. Napoleon doesn't answer the offer, so James Monroe goes over to Paris and raises the price to $10 million.
Rowan was driving them through the French Quarter, giving them a play-by-play commentary on the history of the city.
Instead, Napoleon shocks everyone by announcing he'll give up the entire Louisiana Territory, an expanse of 15 states extending from Florida all the way to Canada, for 15 million. After the math is said and done, New Orleans is basically bought for $7. This fascinating discussion of New Orleans was the most Rowan had said since they'd met. As they toured through the French Quarter in his car, the last 24 hours began to recede in Mellicent's mind like a distant nightmare. But the fire had happened, and now Rowan had decided that she and her brother were his responsibility. He had even sent flowers to her hotel room. When the bouquet had arrived that afternoon, her first thought was that he was trying to make a romantic gesture. The card simply said, "To brighten up your room. R." The gift had been so surprising, but when she knocked on Parker's door to deliver the jeans and t-shirt she had bought him at the mall, she had been stunned to see that Rowan had sent Parker a beautiful bouquet as well. A swift stab of disappointment hit her. The flowers weren't a romantic gesture. The man simply liked giving flowers. But then she had already determined Rowan was odd. Maybe it was a condolence gesture since they had lost the house, a fact she was trying hard not to think about. The shock would be with her for some time before she was ready to face the reality. Rowan was busy explaining to them how Napoleon had never come to New Orleans, but that uptown streets were named after his battles, and one of the first few copies of his death mask was housed in the Cabildo Museum.
"What's a death mask?" Parker asked, perking up in the back seat.
Rowan glanced at Parker in the rearview mirror.
"It's the mold of someone's face cast on their deathbed. Napoleon's mold was stolen, so historians are unable to determine which mask was cast from the original mold and which is a copy. The two top contenders are the masks in the Musée de l'Armée in Paris and the one at the Musée de Malmaison. So if you touched them, would you know the answer?"
Parker asked. Rowan didn't hesitate before saying,
"Yes."
"Did you ever touch something that was Napoleon's?" Parker wanted to know.
Mellicent tried not to roll her eyes. Parker was full of questions for Rowan, but her brother hadn't said two words to her since the dramatic revelation that he was planning to run away. Granted, they hadn't had a moment to sit down and talk, but the silent treatment was beginning to wear on her.
"I did more than that. I found something."
Rowan's eyes had a gleam in them, remembering.
"His sword."
"Whoa!"
Parker leaned forward.
"I was your age. His insignia was engraved on the hilt. It had been damaged and was illegible, but I still knew. He commissioned the sword to be made after his campaign in Egypt."
Mellicent glanced over at Rowan from the corner of her eye, surprised he was continuing to be so talkative. If she didn't know better, she would swear he sounded nervous, like he was talking to fill the silence. Something had happened to him during their afternoon apart. She focused on listening and used it as an excuse to study him. He was wearing black jeans and a cotton stretch, long-sleeved t-shirt that made him look athletic. She had to admit that his gloves looked sexier when he was driving. Rowan caught her assessing stare. She cleared her throat and looked back out the window as he continued with his story.
"The sword disappeared, like so many of Napoleon's possessions did when he was imprisoned by the English. We took it to a laboratory that dealt in advanced metalwork testing, and they were able to show the insignia under the right microscope."
"You sold it?" Mellicent asked. She couldn't imagine touching something that belonged to Napoleon and sensing his past. The man had controlled entire continents and the lives of millions.
"For how much?" Parker chimed in.
"Parker." Mellicent craned her neck around to give him a look. "That's rude."
"What? I'm not asking his salary. It's Napoleon's sword. Chill."
$1.2 million, Rowan answered.
Parker frowned.
"That seems low."
"Oh my God," she said to her brother. "Would you stop?"
"No, it was low," Rowan agreed, clearly trying to diffuse the tension. At the time, my dad was worried that a public auction would garner too much media attention, so we sold it to a military antique collector in the States. 4 years later, when I was 20, another of Napoleon's swords came up for auction from the Bonaparte family. The sword was appraised at $1.6 million, but it sold for $6.5 million and became one of the highest-selling antiquities of all time.
Parker whistled, and everyone fell silent. Millicent crossed her arms and looked out the window again, feeling a weight pressing on her. Finding Breguet's watch had garnered attention, a lot of attention. She hadn't had time to see where else the story had circulated besides the LA Times and YouTube. Not that she wanted to. It'd only unnerve her more. That video had made her a target. There could be dozens of articles about the pocket watch, and here she was, hiding out in New Orleans. They left the French Quarter and took Decatur Street, which soon turned into Magazine Street. As they drove down the winding road filled with restaurants, shops, and bars, she thought the vibe felt a lot like Culver City's walking district, or Soho in New York, which she'd visited once with a friend in college. When Rowan pulled into a small drive next to one of the houses, Millicent received a momentary jolt. Seeing RW Antiques days after clicking on every available picture of it was unreal. Not once had she imagined she'd be visiting the house, let alone soon. The pearl-colored exterior was even more charming than the pictures on the website. A delightful winter garden of pansies and petunias surrounded the wraparound porch, and steep patio steps led to the entrance. The entire house was raised high off the ground, in traditional New Orleans fashion, to safeguard it from flooding. On the way to the front door, she caught Rowan taking off his right glove and trailing a hand over the tips of the flowers, with an intent look on his face. Without slowing his stride, he put his glove back on in one smooth motion before buzzing the front door. The intercom sounded.
"Holly, it's me," he said.
A few moments later, the front door opened, and a silvery blonde woman stepped out. She was in her 30s and dressed in an elegant pencil skirt and silk blouse. She'd accessorized the look with dramatic jewelry, a brass cuff, and ropes of pearls around her neck, and a touch too much makeup.
"Rowan, I..."
Her smile faltered when she noticed he had brought people with him.
"Why, hello."
A professional mask fell into place, and she stepped back to welcome them inside.
"I didn't realize you were bringing clients today."
Her southern drawl was pronounced. Rowan ushered them in.
"They're not clients. They're visiting from L.A. Millicent and Parker Tilpin, I'd like you to meet Holly Beauchesne."
The announcement of Millicent's and Parker's names made Holly's mouth drop open.
"Oh, my lord, you're from the YouTube video."
She looked from Millicent and Parker to Rowan in disbelief.
"You saw it too?"
Parker asked.
"I'm the one who showed it to him," Holly said, sounding like she wished she hadn't.
Everyone stood in the foyer for an awkward moment. Millicent watched the silent exchange between Holly and Rowan and could hear the unspoken words. "Why did you bring them here?" And his, "it's a long story," look. It was obvious Rowan and Holly had a close relationship to enable that kind of nonverbal shorthand. Rowan excused himself and Holly for a few minutes, and they went to the office to talk. They didn't shut the door all the way, and Millicent could hear every word bouncing off the hardwood floors and the old house's thin walls, how she and Parker were connected to what was going on with Stuart, and how he needed Holly to watch them while he was in London. Holly's voice rose.
"You're leaving? And you want me to watch them?"
Millicent couldn't help but cringe. Holly sounded horrified. Millicent felt like going in there to tell her not to worry. She wasn't about to stay in New Orleans and be babysat. Holly shut the office door for privacy, muting their voices. Millicent shook her head and tried to tamp down her annoyance. She moved as far away from them as possible and turned her attention instead to the showrooms. She wandered from room to room, much like Parker was doing. But unlike her brother, who was picking up the merchandise, checking the price tags, and making whistling noises, she kept her arms crossed, with her hands under her elbows. At this point, she was afraid to touch anything. Every piece of furniture and collectible in this house had a story to tell, or Rowan wouldn't have brought it here. From the Viennese silver spice boxes, to the grand chandelier from Bohemia, to the 15th century embossed bowls from Nuremberg. Millicent moved past an inlaid gaming table and drop-front secretaire that looked like they had graced a castle in Europe. Who were the last people to own these treasures? Her hand almost reached out to touch the gaming table, but instead she walked on. The next room held a beautiful assortment of table clocks. Porcelain sculptures from Italy, vase clocks from France, and an ornate Roman chariot where the clock was the wheel. On the wall, a painting from Prague had a clock embedded into the canvas as part of the picture. The room made her smile. Of course Rowan would collect unusual clocks. She finished touring the showroom and stepped through the last doorway at the end of the hall. The chill hit her first, and then the coldness of the air turned invasive, as if invisible fingers were trying to touch her bones. Millicent wrapped her arms around her middle with a twinge of apprehension. Four long tables were draped with black tablecloths. The antiques on the tables were tagged with lot numbers instead of price tags, and many items had a page of typed or handwritten notes tucked beside them. The collection looked Native American, and featured everything from beaded ceremonial dresses and matching moccasins to feathered headdresses, musical flutes, and handmade dolls made from hides. Millicent placed her hand on her chest to calm her heart and ease the sense of dread spreading through her. She had to know why this feeling, this concentration of sadness and loss, was in the room. Making a conscious decision to use her right hand instead of her left, she picked up a small handmade horse from a cluster of toys. If Rowan was correct, her right hand was her more receptive hand and would be the best one for reading an imprint. Immediately she felt a tug and closed her eyes to follow the animal's trail through the darkness, to hear the story of a boy who had to leave his beloved toy behind. Little Deer was one of thousands of children rounded up by the U.S. government, wrenched from his family, and sent to live in a Native American boarding school. He was forbidden to speak his language. His glorious black hair was shorn off. He could no longer walk freely. He had to march. He wore the same uniform day in, day out. Little Deer's memories resounded in the toy horse, along with his fear, his confusion, his shame. On the table along with the horse were toys belonging to other children, handmade by their grandmothers, which had to be left behind and were only seen again in the summer months when the children were allowed to return home. Millicent could hear the sounds of their laughter silenced, feel the brutal push against their spirits to stifle their light. At school, the teachers called Little Deer uncivilized and a savage. He was beaten with horse cords and sticks, and when he ran away, the punishment was much worse. Millicent was trapped in the dark memories, no longer in the room. Like a sleepwalker, she put down the horse and moved to the next table, and reached out to touch one of the wooden pipes decorated with banded feathers. First, she heard the words,
"Eccetto quello."
It is indeed a good day. Spoken so clearly, like the man speaking was standing beside her. Then a torrent of imprints hit her. The images came like a stampede from the last evening this pipe had ever held smoke. It had been passed around with great ceremony by the tribe's medicine man, Yellow Bird, but the ceremony had been interrupted by the arrival of a cavalry of soldiers. The soldiers were escorting another band of Sioux and their ailing chief, Bigfoot, whom they were arresting. The pipe held the fear of that night and the following day, as the soldiers rounded up every weapon from every teepee. The killing started when a soldier's gun went off and shot a deaf man, who was resisting the soldier because he couldn't hear the orders. Within seconds, the panicked troop fired at the crowds and into the teepees, forever burning that winter day red with blood. Men, women, and children were shot like animals while they tried to run.
Melisent, let go!
Melisent could barely register that Rowan was shouting. The grief had eclipsed her. His arms wrapped around her, rooting her back to the present. She dropped the pipe on the table with a clatter and buried her face in her hands. Her legs were about to buckle as her whole body shook from the annihilation she had witnessed. The pipe had showed her the memories of the hundreds of men, women, and children who had died. "I didn't know," she choked the words out. Rowan stroked her hair.
"I'm sorry. I should have shut the door."
Parker came rushing to the doorway with Holly right behind him.
"What happened? Mel?"
he asked, alarmed.
"She touched something,"
Rowan said firmly.
"Give us a minute."
Melisent was too devastated to care that she was making a scene. The room was spinning. Her sense of gravity was gone. The muscles in her stomach cramped, and she thought she might be sick.
"Please give us a minute,"
he ordered, sounding short. Holly ushered Parker back to the front of the store. Rowan took both of Melisent's hands and rubbed them between his, the friction of his gloved fingers hot on her skin.
"Melisent, listen to me. You've had a shock. I'm going to show you a finger position to help calm you. It's called a mudra."
Melisent shook her head, unable to make sense of what he was talking about. He took both of her hands and molded them together. Then he joined the tips of her little finger and ring finger and pointed everything to the floor. Both his hands controlled hers as he sculpted them into the intricate hand position.
"Focus on the feeling of energy flowing out of your body, through your hands and to the floor."
His voice sounded sure. She didn't question what he was telling her to do. His hands became anchors around hers, rebuilding the floor she was standing on. Her breathing began to slow, and she could feel her pulse calming as he kept talking.
"Focus on your hands and your breath. That's it. In and out. Breathe in and out."
He stood with her, continuing to cup her hands and adopting the same stance until they were breathing in unison. Through his breath and body, she could feel him giving her his strength. A powerful bond had been forged between them, and she began to understand why he was helping her. She was starting out on a path, one that he was far, far ahead of her on, but they both shared the same ability, and he understood its dimensions and pitfalls. Within minutes, she could feel her equilibrium returning. She opened her eyes to find Rowan watching her. He lifted a hand and trailed his fingers down the side of her face.
"Better?"
"Yes. Thank you," she whispered, her voice hoarse. She looked down at her hands, still keeping them locked. "What is this?" She raised her arms and studied how each of her fingers were connected. It had actually helped.
"The Shakti Mudra. Think of it like meditative yoga for the hands. Shakti is the essence of power gesture. You use it when you need to rebalance your energy quickly."
She nodded, even though she secretly hoped she'd never need to use it again. She looked down at the pipe lying innocently on the table.
"What was it I saw?" "December 29th, 1890. The massacre at Wounded Knee, South Dakota. Many of the things here belong to the Lakota Sioux who died that day."
Melisent wrapped her arms around herself and shivered. She looked down at the tables, at the children's toys, unable to hide her repulsion. "Why are you collecting such things?" He glanced back at her with surprise.
I'm not. I'm returning them. These are heirlooms that belong to the descendants of those who survived.
Rowan stared at the tables, an intense light entering his eyes.
But the memories they hold...
Who would want them? Was the question she wanted to ask, but didn't.
Rowan picked up the pipe Mellicent had touched. This medicine pipe.